Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, we often try and make things accessible for people. I'm going to go out and say it, that this episode is going to be more technical than most, but it serves a purpose. What is that purpose?
Yeah, no, here's the purpose. On the show today is Paul Baiocchi of Alps. And Paul Baiocchi, let me just take you to my personal career. I'm going to take you back, Joel, to the year 2006, 2007, 2008, right around there. This is what, 12, 13 years ago? I get assigned ETFs in data. I'm in data. And I don't know much about them. So where do I learn about them? I go to this place, Index Universe, as well as reading books and whatnot. And Index Universe was a hotbed of ETF analysis way before it was cool. And Paul Baiocchi was one of these original analysts. They had about 10 people there who were really good. I mean, they'd be good today, but they were 10 years ahead of their time. This was led by Dave Nadig, who we've had on the show, and Matt Hogan. Dave now at ETF Trends, Matt is now at Bitwise. But they had a whole crew, and I would listen to their podcasts. And Paul had a podcast. He wrote articles. And since then, he went to Fidelity. A lot of them went other places. And so he was at Fidelity. Now he's at Alps. So today we'd be talking to an analyst who is smart as an analyst and used to have to judge ETFs critically, who now went to an issuer. And now he's got to talk to advisors about the ETFs that this one firm sells and make the case. And so we wanted to sort of take you into how an analyst, a specialist, talks to an advisor about why they should use not only the ETF that the firm sells, but that category. Like, why should I buy an energy ETF now? And then why should I buy yours?
In other words, this episode is you taking me to your record shop.
Yeah, this is definitely someone who I would call an early influence on my career. So it's fun to talk to him, A, and B, just talk about some of those early days, but also really talk about what he does today and how he uses all that knowledge. And, you know, it is interesting. Once you go to an issuer, you kind of have to sell their products. And it is an interesting, you know, hat you have to wear. But I am certain that all of his analysis on all the articles he wrote have got to come in very handy.
Who's Alps and how big are they?
They're a mid-size issuer. They've been around for a while. I don't know, probably 10, 15 years. They've got $6 billion in assets. So I guess that puts them right around the top 20, somewhere maybe 20, 25th biggest. They have 16 products. And I know them for things like AMLP, which is the big MLP ETF. Those are pass-through high-yielding securities. And also the dogs. They have like S-Dog, E-Dog. These are dogs of the Dow ETF. So it's a, you know, honestly, this is a classic like shop that had a couple hits, enough to keep it going. I mean, you need a couple. None of these, AMLP was a blockbuster. And then they had a few moderate hits. And then some ones they struggle with. It's really a metaphor for the whole industry. But as long as you get a couple hits, you're good. And I think a lot of what they do now is making sure they reintroduce those ETFs that were hits, but also the new ones they have that can complement those. So, which we'll discuss with Paul.
This time on Trillions, climbing the Alps with Paul Baiocchi. Paul, welcome to Trillions.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So talk to me about what you do.
So currently I am what in the ETF industry is typically defined as a specialist. So I support a subset of Alps, SS&C Alps ETFs, specifically in the MLP energy infrastructure space. So basically I'm the subject matter expert for our wholesaling team. I help them when they're meeting with advisors to talk at a high level about the industry, the product suite, portfolio solutions. And then I also work with our portfolio management team, our capital markets team, and then our management team to ensure that distribution strategy on down to portfolio management is operating in a way that's as efficient as possible.
So talk to me about your journey. How did you get there?
Yeah, sure. So this podcast is in many ways a decade in the making. I mean, Eric and I have known each other for quite a while. And it's funny because 10 years ago, I was at Index Universe, which became ETF.com. And it was at the time this team of analysts that they built to really disrupt the way that advisors and investors thought about and analyzed ETFs. We were sort of going after Morningstar in terms of an ETF classification system and ETF analytics. And that's really how I cut my teeth in the ETF world. Before that, I was working at a small RIA that was building indexes for UITs. And we built an index for, and this is going way back now, the first global shipping ETF, SEA, which you think about launching an ETF in 2008, 2009 on global shipping, not exactly the best timing. And so I would say that my timing in many ways in life isn't always perfect, as I'm sure is the case with everybody. But now, 10 years on, I've gone to Fidelity to help them build out their ETF capability and grow their asset base. And now I'm at SS&C Alps.
I want to go back to the index universe world. That was before ETF.com. They used to have these conferences. I remember, Paul, the first time I went there, I was probably the only person from Bloomberg besides Chris Condon, who covered funds at the time. It was two of us there. The last conference, I think there was like 20 people from Bloomberg. But this was probably back in 2013-ish, maybe. And I remember Jim Wyant opened the conference with, "Welcome to the right side of history." And there was a buzz about it. And that was before a trillion. Now they've got 5 trillion, basically. But for a long time, ETFs were the underdog. And do you, as you go out on the road and you talk to clients knowing all that, and now you're talking to them about, like, say, AMLP or a specific ETF, how far have advisors come, or the users, in using them? And also, how much further could this industry grow?
So I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of sort of the counterculture of the early days in the ETF market. And I think advisors back then were being introduced to the ETF wrapper. And in many ways, you just had this opposition, this structural opposition to the ETF wrapper because of either misinformation or just misconceptions about what ETFs were designed to do and what they were actually doing. And I think 10 years on, advisors are less opposed to the sort of ideal of the ETF. And they're more accepting of the fact that ETFs can fit within a broader advisory strategy. And that's important because it gets to the heart of what these advisors are trying to do, which is just investment solutions that take into account things like asset location and taxes and financial planning. And so now when I talk to an advisor, that conversation about what an ETF does or how an ETF operates or what the creation and redemption process is, that those conversations don't need to be had, because there's now this varied user base of ETFs that maybe didn't exist 10 years ago. And the intelligence around ETF application has evolved and accelerated in many ways. And so it makes it easier to have the conversation about the exposure and the product, as opposed to having to take 3 steps back and start from scratch, if that makes sense.
How often do you meet with someone who's like, "WTF is an ETF?"
Well, or somebody who's just read the latest article in the FT or something that just says they've never been tested or they're going to blow up. Is that still a thing? Because those articles do come out, I don't know, quarterly. There's usually one that just like has everyone buzzing. But then the flows just come in despite it. It feels like they almost are meaningless at this point. But do advisors still have worries?
You do. And you never want to paint with too broad a brush in terms of stereotyping certain demographics or certain cohorts of the advisory community. But I do think that some of the older advisors who are used to doing things a certain way or very comfortable with a certain product type or a certain strategy are more likely to sort of take the bait, as it were, around some of the sensationalist research or articles on ETFs. So you do still have a conversation where a guy in the fixed income space will say, "Hey, we saw these products trade at deep discounts and I told you so." And in some ways, that's just the confirmation bias that exists in people generally these days, whether it be financial advisors or otherwise. And so I think when you get down to it, the reality is that a lot of the ETF flows now are just structural in nature. I mean, there's automatic buying that takes place as a result of home office model subscriptions at the big wirehouses or otherwise. And so some of the flows just happen regardless of what's happening on the ground level in some ways.
In other words, the ETFs are more in models, target date funds, and just where the money's coming in, rain or shine, right? And then there's tactical money. Speaking of tactical, let's dive into some of the ETFs here, because I think the ones that you're an expert or the specialist in now at ALPS, I think will get us to some interesting conversations. Now, let's talk about AMLP. This is the MLP ETF. I believe it's the largest MLP ETF on the market, right? And
absolutely,
it's one of the oldest. And this is a classic case of what you guys would have done at Index Universe and what we still do, which is AMLP versus, say, AMJ, which is the ETN, or the one that I think MLPX, which only owns 25% MLPs. There's a tax issue with MLPs and the way that they get taxed, which makes it all kind of a picking your poison kind of situation. Now, you're on team AMLP now, so sell me on AMLP if I'm an advisor and I say, well, there's such a big tax drag inside that thing. Why don't I just use the ETN instead, which doesn't have that?
So it's one of these trade-offs that investors make in the markets, in that if you want to own an individual MLP, you're going to get issued a K-1. And for some advisors, that's just not palatable. Or for some investors, that's just not palatable. And so if you want to be in the MLP space, which is a pass-through vehicle and has some interesting income characteristics, some tax deferral associated with them, that means that in order to get a diversified pool of MLPs, you have to make some trade-offs, because the RIC structure and IRS guidelines cap MLPs at 25% of a RIC compliant mutual fund or ETF. And so the workaround is to create a C corp around the ETF. And so, without getting too far in the weeds, but to answer your question, that can create some tax drag in periods of positive performance. Now, currently AMLP has what's called a deferred tax asset, which means there is no tax drag for the foreseeable future, given the near-term performance of MLPs. And so removing the tax consequences or some of the tax complications of running a C corp ETF, what I'll say is 80% of AMLP's distributions historically have been considered tax deferred return of capital, which means that portion of your income that's coming into the fund just lowers your cost basis and isn't taxed in that tax year when it's kicked out. And so in that way, you do have some tax benefits for a taxable investor that you don't get in an ETN, which is just paying out a stream of income, replicating the income that's thrown off by the underlying securities in the index. And it's taxed as ordinary income as any coupon payment on a fixed income instrument would be. And so this gets down to sort of asset location and tax consideration. So if you're in a IRA or a tax deferred account, something like an ETN might be more appropriate, because you're not really concerned about tax deferral. And in a taxable account, that tax deferral can be significant, because let's say that you're an older investor who's planning on passing on your investments to your children or your grandchildren. You get a step up in basis at that point. And that can be significant in terms of estate planning and other tools that advisors are now being asked to deliver to their clients. And so AMLP is the largest, most liquid ETF. To your point, it was the first MLP-only ETF launch. We just had our 10-year anniversary and did a little bit of a bell ringing at the NYSE and some press around that. And so in many ways, as you know better than anybody, Eric, the first mover advantage in ETFs can be significant in the right categories. And MLPs have proven to be that over time. Now, MLPX and the RIC compliant energy infrastructure products are sort of apples to oranges in some ways to AMLP, because they cap their MLP exposure at 25%, which means you mute some of the tax deferral and you include some C-corps that don't have the same structure as an MLP from a tax perspective or from a pass-through perspective, you still play on the same theme. And in recent years, Kinder Morgan and ONEOK and some of these large MLPs have converted to C-corps. So in many ways, they're all different ways to play this theme, which is companies that move, that process and store crude oil and natural gas. And that's a pretty simple business model. You collect a fee for doing that. And that leads to pretty steady cash flows relative to other pockets of the energy complex. And so if I'm going to make the case for being in the energy infrastructure space, that's it. They historically have pretty compelling distributions and dividends. The yields right now in the market in fixed income or in utilities or REITs or other sort of bond proxy sectors is somewhat low. And advisors who are trying to generate income off the equity allocation in their asset allocation might be looking for something like AMLP or the energy infrastructure as an alternative, which historically has had pretty low correlations to REITs and utilities and other income producing asset classes.
Sure. And I think most people out there who've heard of MLPs think of it as yield. And just so for people who it's master limited partnership, they, you know, it's these companies that have the pipes that which brings me to another question, which, yeah, I'll say AMLP yields 14% currently. So that's a juicy yield. MLPX, by the way, is half that. So to your point, that has more of the MLPs and the higher yield. Although now we're in energy, and I know energy has had a tough go of it. Like, have you found it difficult that you're in that sector? Yes, you have the yield, but you're in energy. Energy has really taken it on the chin lately. And could we see an energy rebound? That's something that I think many people just, some people say will never happen. I'm not in that camp. I think there will be an energy rebound. I don't see energy consumption going down all that much. But what do you say about that?
So I think you're being a little bit diplomatic in saying that energy has been a difficult place to be. It's been an awful place to be for certain periods of time recently. And so you look at the energy's weighting in the S&P 500 just as a way to reflect that. And it's at its lowest levels in 30 plus years. And that's, I think, aligned really well with this growth value disparity that we've seen in the market. And so you can sort of relate the two in the sense that there are value managers out there who are pounding the table saying value is going to come back. And we get these short pops in value relative to growth. And people say, is this the start of that mean reversion as it relates to value versus growth? And those tend to be short-lived, or at least they have recently. I think energy is very similar to that in the sense that we've had these short periods of outperformance. People are sort of saying, well, is this the energy renaissance? Is this when energy starts to outperform the market and retake its leadership in the market? And then you get negative headlines, or you get a pause, or you get a significant period of extended negative performance. And so I don't think that energy, as we currently see it, goes away anytime soon. I mean, the reality is that natural gas, in any version of the Green New Deal or otherwise, is going to be an important bridge to a renewable energy future. We rely on it to generate electricity. If you're going to be plugging your car into the wall of your garage, that electricity currently isn't coming from wind or solar, and it's unlikely to come extensively from wind, solar, or hydrogen in the future. And so natural gas does provide us with a bridge. Crude oil, on the other hand, is the one that's perhaps most at risk, at least from an existential perspective right now. And as we think about a more progressive or overhaul of our energy policy. But even then, if you look at some of the projections for energy demand going forward, a lot of the incremental demand for crude oil isn't coming from highway mileage or jet fuel. It's coming from petrochemical demand in emerging markets specifically. And that's not likely to subside anytime soon. And so there are these structural challenges facing the legacy fossil fuel industry that I think are real and investors have to be wary of. But as it relates to midstream energy infrastructure, I mean, the reality is that pipelines are valuable assets. And if you look at the DAPL news where there was an attempt to shut down this pipeline that was already operating for an environmental review and then a court stay and then an abandonment of a pipeline on the East Coast. I mean, if anything, that means that existing pipelines are more valuable than they were because they're going to be harder to build and harder to get approval for. And the production in the United States whether it's in any of these various basins where fracking is going on and natural gas and crude oil is being produced, those pipes connect that to the various demand sites, whether it be a refining facility for crude oil or whether it be a utility site. And that's going to continue to be the case. Now, if you're an investor and you have some energy exposure, whether it's AMLP or something like, let's say, XLE, a broad energy ETF that includes the integrated companies and some of those large oil service companies, well, I do think that it's prudent to think about how you can pair that legacy fossil fuel or legacy energy position with something a little bit more growth oriented, or maybe even an option on some of these emerging technologies in the energy space. And so you talk about the ALPS ETF lineup, and ACES, which is our renewable energy ETF, is something that we talk to advisors a lot about, combining with, say, AMLP or a legacy energy position as a way to sort of pair the current with the future.
I want to talk about ACES more, Paul, because that's had a great year, like 60% year to date that it's up, right? What exactly are you guys accomplishing in that fund?
So it fits within this thematic lineup of ETFs that SS&C Alps has launched in the past couple of years. And it tries to give you a blended exposure to a range of different themes within a theme. And what I mean by that is, you think about renewable energy and people might think of wind or solar, but there's also fuel cell technology and battery technology, hydrogen, for example, that are all part of this broader renewable energy push and are all going to have a role to play in the future energy mix within the country. And so what ACES tries to do is give you exposure to all of those themes in a way that maybe a pure play solar fund wouldn't, or maybe a pure play wind fund would not. And I think that's why it's been popular. I mean, it's over $300 million in assets now. To your point, year-to-date performance has been really compelling. And I think advisors are starting to use it in the way that I described, as a complement to their legacy energy position. Because the reality is, you can get a diversified energy sector ETF, for example, for less than 10 basis points. But you might be willing to pay up a little bit from an expense ratio perspective to get the growth-oriented nature of renewable energy exposure as a complement to that. And it's not that you don't necessarily have exposure to some of those themes in your portfolio through the S&P 500 or your diversified equity ETF, because a lot of these things sort of blur the line between technology and energy, because that's just the nature of renewable energy development and production. But when you get it targeted in this way, you do in many ways provide yourself with some optionality on these legacy fossil fuel companies, the Exxons, the Chevrons of the world.
And this is this one's getting a huge kick from Tesla. So Tesla is the top holding. That helps. But yeah, it's interesting when you think about ESG. A lot of people think about like taking companies out that are bad, right? This is not really that. This is more of a theme fund going for a small group of companies that are trying to make money in the clean energy sector. Totally different. So this would probably get classified under ESG. It's in a big tent kind of way, but it is not ESG per se. It's more of a play on a growth area.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. In fact, it did get the blessing of the ESG reviewers, if you will. But to your point, it's not a fund that's taking the whole market and screening companies based on an ESG methodology by Bloomberg or MSCI. It's simply a strategy that happens to fit within the construct of how people think about ESG. And one point about ESG that I think is worth mentioning is, people focus on the E and they focus on the S, and certainly ACES would in theory fit the E to perhaps a capital E, but the G in that is really important. And it gets sort of lost in the shuffle of a lot of ESG conversations. And so there are pockets of the market that are making strong governance improvements that don't necessarily fit that E or that S in most investor minds. And AMLP is one of those. And I just mention it not to sort of force it in here, but just to remind investors and advisors that G part is really important, because you can have a technology company that knocks it out of the park on the E and the S, but their governance might not be as strong as you might need it to be given the goal of a broader ESG initiative.
This is a huge problem for ESG, what you're tapping into, because there's just images people have of energy or oil, but they forget the S and the G. I think in Just Capital's ETF, Exxon is in there. But if energy has a rally, I think ESG people that have completely excluded energy are going to be unhappy for whatever, however long that rally lasts. But on the flip side, I will push back on the G a little. There's an interesting case with Berkshire. Berkshire is not in like any ESG ETFs because the governance, I think it's 57% independent board and the average is like 86 or something. And Buffett's like, yeah, I've been on independent boards. They're not independent. And it's an interesting issue because it's Buffett talking. And so that's why ESG is like, how did Churchill describe Russia? A labyrinth wrapped in a mystery inside a riddle. I feel like that's ESG for me. I constantly find contradictions and things that overrule the other thing.
But your point is a good one, Paul, that the G can actually, you know, there's a weighting to it that, and a lot of people have said this, that the G is actually more important than the E and the S. I want to talk about the dogs, though, right? This is another success for you guys, and it's based on the dogs of the Dow theory, right? Can you explain that?
Yeah, so in the most simple terms, the dogs of the Dow theory just said of those 30 companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the ones with the highest yields are effectively the companies that you want to own the next year because based on mean reversion or historical performance, those are the ones that are most likely to outperform the market on a go-forward basis. And so what the dogs do, and it started with SDOG, which is really sort of an old ETF that's been around quite a while and has been used by a wide range of advisors and investors over a long period of time. It was one I remember back at my ETF.com days interacting with Jeremy Held, a former Alps guy, about and trying to understand what they were trying to achieve with it. And it's pretty simple. You just sort of take the highest yielding stocks from the 10 at the time and now 11 different sectors of the market, and you don't have market weights on the sectors. You have equal weights to all of the sectors. And so the idea is you're just sort of maximizing your exposure to the companies with the highest yield, which within each sector of the market. And it's a different way to look at value. It's a different way to look at yield. And you think about most dividend strategies, they take the whole market. They do some simple, in the case of some of the first generation dividend ETFs, screens for the highest yielding stocks. Maybe they try and protect that yield a little bit by payout ratio or something to that effect. And then you just weight them based on that score. And you end up having a lot of exposure to utilities and to staples and some of the sort of higher yielding sectors of the market, sort of by definition. And then you have some of the other strategies, which are aristocrat strategies, which look at companies that have paid dividends for 20 years or grown dividends for 20 years. Or perhaps you do something that's a little bit more methodical or quantitative in nature, trying to screen out for the quality of that income stream. And so you have all of these different approaches to dividends, which are really aligned closely with a value strategy because the dividend factor tends to look a lot like the value factor over time. But the dogs is just different because it takes this really old world Wall Street strategy, the dogs of the Dow theory, and applies it in the ETF wrapper. And it was one of the first to do it, which I think makes it really relatable to advisors. And then we've applied it to other markets. So we've got an emerging markets and an international, and then more recently a real estate dog. And it's worth mentioning that S Networks, the creator of those indexes, is now part of the Alerian family of indexes. And Alerian is our partner on AMLP and ENFR, the index provider for those strategies. And so in some ways, this relationship between issuer and index provider is being reflected in at SS&C Alps in a way that is perhaps unique to the industry given the changes that have been made between self-indexing or otherwise.
Yeah, and you brought up something interesting. SDOG spawned EDOG, and there's three or four dogs now. And when you have a hit ETF, do you meet in a room and say, okay, we should just run with this a little bit? And like a movie, if you have a hit movie, you come out with a sequel?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've only been at SS&C Alps since the beginning of the year. And so I haven't been in a lot of those product development sessions. Now, I have been in product development sessions at other firms. And so I do think that if you have a strategy that's successful and it makes sense to port it to a different market, whether it be region-specific, development-specific, or even cap-specific, certainly firms are going to do the research and determine if it makes sense to launch those products. And I think SDog was certainly a template for EDog and IDog and RDog.
There's another name in the lineup of your ETFs I want to talk about, Riverfront. You've got a couple ETFs with Riverfront in the name. I want you to go into them, but I recall when I wrote my ETF book, Riverfront, I refer to them as the ETF whisperer, because a lot of firms were going to them because they use ETFs in their models. And they were telling the ETF firm, hey, you should come out with this. One of those products is BKLN to Invesco. I think another one was SPLV. MLPX, I think, was one. I think they told Jeremy Schwartz at WisdomTree they should make DXJ lean towards exporters before DXJ blew up. And then I get the feeling they were like, hey, we're tired of giving away all our ideas. But now there's three of them branded under your product lineup. How did that happen and what do they do?
So I think Riverfront is a great example of these early ETF strategists that have in many ways helped shape the ETF industry, as you described. I mean, you think about Medfaber and Cambria, there's a number of these firms. Even Edelman worked with BlackRock, I believe, to launch some ETFs, or at least to help conceive some ETF strategies. And so I think that feedback loop has been very positive in terms of innovation and ETF strategy development. And Riverfront I've known forever. I mean, Rob Glaunia and I sort of go way back, and I've moderated some panels with him at Inside ETFs. And so I've always been really familiar with the firm. But I mean, as RIGS, for example, the Riverfront Strategic Income Fund, relates to the broader SS&C Alps business, I think is probably more revealing than sort of digging into the individual strategies themselves, in the sense that Alps has this really unique business where we have a ton of different partners, whether it be index providers or advisors who we partner with, either from a distribution perspective. Remember, Alps is the distribution partner for the select sector spiders. And then you have a strategy like RIGS, which is sort of a multi-asset income strategy designed and built by Riverfront that needed the infrastructure to manage and to actually execute on that ETF. And the piping, the infrastructure of an ETF, whether it be the day-to-day operations or otherwise, is critically important to the success of an ETF. And that's one of the sort of many services that Alps as a broader brand offers to firms like Riverfront. And so I think the idea is that historically some of these advisors have gone out and launched their own mutual fund, which is just an easier way to sort of wrap up their strategies for their clients. Instead of cobbling together a mix of different mutual funds, you sort of have your one-stop shop mutual fund that provides you the exposure that you need for those smaller clients. And the ETF wrapper just happens to be the latest evolution in that product delivery mechanism that allows a firm like Riverfront to deliver on some of these. And the added benefit is that, unlike a mutual fund, anybody can buy the ETF. And so in theory, you not only have this mechanism to deliver your strategies to your existing clients, you open up the door to all of these other potential clients and in theory, leverage the Alps distribution team to help deliver that to a wider audience.
You go way back, right? I remember listening to the podcast with you and Hugo Egbeniki. I think I said that right. I know. Yeah. I see him once in a while. He's great.
He's one of my favorite people.
I know. You guys had a nice little spark. You followed Dave and Matt, who was tough act to follow, but you did a great job.
Thank you.
Those podcasts were like graduate school for me at the time. And again, we were talking about ETFs had a trillion back then. What inning are we in? Now you have that base knowledge. Now you're on the road talking to advisors. So where do you see this going, both ETFs and passive as a percentage of the market?
Well, I think the point about Dave and Matt, I think, is an interesting one 10 years ago, because what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, where they were on stage saying ETFs are going to get disrupted by direct indexing?
Yeah, which so, I By the way, we've pushed back on that a little bit. I think they got a little ahead of themselves. I think direct indexing may carve out a 5% niche, but I just don't see it disrupting. I don't know. Do you have a different take?
I was aligned with them, and I still think that direct indexing will have a large role to play, but I think it's one of those sort of old adages where people overestimate what can be done in a year and underestimate what can be done in five. And so I think in some ways direct indexing is an example of that, but I do think that the ETF asset base is going to continue to grow both through the market move and through increased adoption. I mean, again, we talked about the structural drivers of ETF flows, and I think that will continue, but I do think that there are disruptive forces out there that will challenge the ETF orthodoxy, and whether that be tokenized versions of an S&P 500 ETF that exists on a blockchain and perhaps even lowers the cost of getting exposure and lowering the friction of getting exposure to the S&P 500 in the version that exists now in an ETF. I mean, there are threats, and that's one of the beauties of this market and of this industry in some ways, is that there's always innovation taking place. And the minute you rest on your laurels, no matter how great this ETF run has been, you have to be aware of them and try to understand them so that you can do your own job better and hopefully provide the clients that you're working with, regardless of what step you are in the value chain.
All right, Paul, I got to ask my closing question. What's your favorite ETF ticker?
Oh, man.
What's your favorite ALPS ticker and what's your favorite non-ALPS ticker?
So I love ACES just because it's a great product, but also I just think it's a great ticker. I mean, AMLP is one of those really, what's the word I'm looking for?
Serviceable.
Specific.
Yeah.
And like straightforward, right? I mean, there's not a lot of nuance to it. It says exactly what it is right out of the gate. And so I think Robo's a cool ticker. I've always been sort of fascinated by the tickers that explain what the fund does in four letters in a way that you wouldn't have thought was possible. And what's funny is, you know, just to sort of go inside baseball a little bit, I think more ETF issuers than you would think go to Urban Dictionary when trying to determine what their tickers are.
All right, Paul Bjocke, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
My pleasure. This was great. Thank you, guys. Have a great rest of your week and Labor Day weekend.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find more about ALPS at alpsfunds.com. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.